longer has any need of a man's name, for he has become the avatar of the gods. How do you distinguish one High Septon from another? With difficulty. One has to say the fat one, or the one before the fat one, or the old one who died in his sleep. You can always winkle out their birth names if you like, but they take umbrage if you use them. It reminds them that they were born ordinary men, and they do not like that. My lord husband tells me this new one was born with filth beneath his fingernails. So I suspect. As a rule, the most devout elevate one of their own, but there have been exceptions. Grand Maester Pycelle had informed her of the history at tedious length. During the reign of King Balor the Blessed, a simple stonemason was chosen as High Septon. He worked stone so beautifully that Balor decided he was the smith reborn in mortal flesh. The man could neither read nor write, nor recall the words of the simplest of prayers. Some still claimed that Balor's hand had the man poisoned to spare the realm embarrassment. After that one died, an 8-year-old boy was elevated, once more at King Balor's urging. The boy worked miracles, his grace declared. Though even his little healing hands could not save Balor during his final fast. Lady Merryweather gave a laugh. 8 years old. Perhaps my son could be High Septon. He is almost 7. Does he pray a lot? The queen asked. He prefers to play with swords. A real boy, then. Can he name all 7 gods? I think so. I shall have to take him under consideration. Circe did not doubt that there were any number of boys who would do more honour to the crystal crown than the wretch on whom the most devout had chosen to bestow it. This is what comes of letting fools and cowards rule themselves. Next time I will choose their master for them. And the next time might not be long in coming, if the new High Septon continued to annoy her. Balor's hand had little to teach Circe Lannister where such matters were concerned. "Clear the way!" Sir Osmond Kettleblack was shouting. "Make way for the Queen's Grace!" The litter began to slow, which could only mean that they were near the top of the hill. "You should bring this son of yours to court," Circe told Lady Merryweather. 6 is not too young. Tommen needs other boys about him. Why not your son?" Joffrey had never had a close friend of his own age that she recalled. The poor boy was always alone. I had Jamie when I was a child, and Melara until she fell into the well. Joff had been fond of the Hound, to be sure, but that was not friendship. He was looking for the father he never found in Robert. A little foster brother might be just what Tommen needs to wean him away from Margaery and her hens. In time they might grow as close as Robert and his boyhood friend Ned Stark. A fool, but a loyal fool. Tommen will have need of loyal friends to watch his back. Your Grace is kind, but Russell has never known any home but Longtable. I fear he would be lost in this great city. In the beginning, the Queen allowed, but he will soon outgrow that, as I did. When my father sent for me to court, I wept, and Jamie raged, until my aunt sat me down in the stone garden and told me there was no one in King's Landing that I need ever fear. "You are a lioness," she said, "and it is for all the lesser beasts to fear you. Your son will find his courage, too. Surely you would prefer to have him close at hand, where you could see him every day. He is your only child, is he not?" "For the present, my lord husband has asked the gods to bless us with another son in case—" "I know." She thought of Joffrey, clawing at his neck. In his last moments he had looked to her in desperate appeal, and a sudden memory had stopped her heart. A drop of red blood hissing in a candle flame, a croaking voice that spoke of crowns and shrouds, of death at the hands of the Valonqar. Outside the litter, Sir Osmond was shouting something, and someone was shouting back. The litter jerked to a halt. "Are you all dead?" roared Kettleblack. "Get out of the bloody way!" The Queen pulled back a corner of the curtain and beckoned to Sir Merrin Trant. "What seems to be the trouble?" "The sparrows, Your Grace." Sir Merrin wore white scale armour beneath his cloak. His helm and shield were slung from his saddle. Camping in the street. We'll make them move. Do that, but gently. I do not care to be caught up in another riot. Circe, let the curtain fall. This is absurd. It is, Your Grace. Lady Meriwether agreed. The High Septon should have come to you, and these wretched sparrows. He feeds them, coddles them, blesses them, yet will not bless the king. The blessing was an empty ritual, she knew, but rituals and ceremonies had power in the eyes of the ignorant. Aegon the Conqueror himself had dated the start of his realm from the day the High Septon anointed him in Old Town. This wretched priest will obey, or learn how weak and human he still is. Orton says it is the gold he really wants, that he means to withhold his blessing until the crown resumes its payments. The faith will have its gold as soon as we have peace. Septon Torbert and Septon Reynard had been most understanding of her plight, unlike the wretched Bravosi, who had hounded poor Lord Giles so mercilessly that he had taken to his bed, coughing up blood. We had to have those ships. She could not rely upon the Arbor for her navy. The Red Wines were too close to the Tyrells. She needed her own strength at sea. The Dromans rising on the river would give her that. Her flagship would dip twice as many oars as King Robert's hammer. Arrain had asked her leave to name her Lord Tywin, which Circe had been pleased to grant. She looked forward to hearing men speak of her father as a she. Another of the ships would be named Sweet Circe, and would bear a gilded figurehead carved in her likeness, clad in mail and lion helm with spear in hand. Brave Joffrey, Lady Joanna, and Lioness would follow her to sea, along with Queen Marjorie, Golden Rose, Lord Renly, Lady Olenna, and Princess Myrcella. The Queen had made the mistake of telling Tommen he might name the last five. He had actually chosen Moonboy for one. Only when Lord Aurain suggested that men might not want to serve on a ship named for a fool, had the boy reluctantly agreed to honour his sister instead. "If this ragged Septon thinks to make me buy Tommen's blessing, he will soon learn better," she told Taina. The Queen did not intend to truckle to a pack of priests. The litter halted yet again so suddenly that Circe jerked. "Oh, this is infuriating!" She leaned out once more and saw that they had reached the top of Visenya's Hill. Ahead loomed the great Sept of Baelor, with its magnificent dome and seven shining towers. But between her and the marble steps lay a sullen sea of humanity, brown and ragged and unwashed. Sparrows, she thought, sniffing, though no sparrows had ever smelled so rank. Circe was appalled. Kyburn had brought her reports of their numbers, but hearing about them was one thing and seeing them another. Hundreds were encamped upon the plaza, hundreds more in the gardens. Their cook fires filled the air with smoke and stinks. Rough-spun tents and miserable hovels made of mud and scrap wood besmirched the pristine white marble. They were even huddled on the steps beneath the great sept's towering doors. Sir Osmond came trotting back to her. Beside him rode Sir Osfrid, mounted on a stallion as golden as his cloak. Osfrid was the middle kettle-black, quieter than his siblings, more apt to scowl than smile, and crueler as well, if the tales are true. Perhaps I should have sent him to the wall. Grand Maester Pycelle had wanted an older man, more seasoned in the ways of war, to command the gold cloaks, and several of her other counsellors had agreed with him. Sir Osfrid is seasoned quite sufficiently, she had told them, but even that did not shut them up. They yap at me like a pack of small, annoying dogs. Her patience with Pycelle had all but run its course. He had even had the temerity to object to her sending to Dorne for a master-at-arms, on the grounds that it might offend the Tyrells. "Why do you think I'm doing it?" she had asked him scornfully. "Beg pardon, Your Grace," said Sir Osmond. "My brother's summoning more gold cloaks. We'll clear a path, never fear." "I do not have the time. I will continue on, afoot. Please, Your Grace." Taina caught her arm. "They frighten me. There are hundreds of them, and so dirty." Circe kissed her cheek. "The lion does not fear the sparrow. But it is good of you to care. I know you love me well, my lady. Sir Osmond, kindly help me down." If I had known I was going to have to walk, I would have dressed for it. She wore a white gown slashed with cloth of gold, lacy but demure. It had been several years since the last time she had donned it, and the Queen found it uncomfortably tight about the middle. "Sir Osmond, Sir Merrin, you will accompany me. Sir Osfrid, see that my litter comes to no harm." Some of the sparrows looked gaunt and hollow-eyed enough to eat her horses. As she made her way through the ragged throng, past their cook-fires, wagons, and crude shelters, the Queen found herself remembering another crowd that had once gathered on this plaza. The day she wed Robert Baratheon, thousands had turned out to cheer for them. All the women wore their best, and half the men had children on their shoulders. When she had emerged from inside the sept, hand in hand with the young king, the crowd sent up a roar so loud it could be heard in Lannisport. "They like you well, my lady," Robert whispered in her ear. "See, every face is smiling." For that one short moment, she had been happy in her marriage, until she chanced to glance at Jamie. "No," she remembered thinking, "not every face, my lord." No one was smiling now. The looks the sparrows gave her were dull, sullen, hostile. They made way, but reluctantly. If they were truly sparrows, a shout would send them flying. 100 gold cloaks with staves and swords and maces could clear this rabble quick enough. That was what Lord Tywin would have done. He would have ridden over them instead of walking through. When she saw what they had done to Baelor the Beloved, the Queen had cause to rue her soft heart. The great marble statue that had smiled serenely over the plaza for 100 years was waist-deep in a heap of bones and skulls. Some of the skulls had scraps of flesh still clinging to them. A crow sat atop one such, enjoying a dry, leathery feast. Flies were everywhere. "What is the meaning of this?" Circe demanded of the crowd. "Do you mean to bury blessed Baelor in a mountain of carrion?" A one-legged man stepped forward, leaning on a wooden crutch. "Your Grace, these are the bones of holy men and women murdered for their faith. Septons, scepters, brothers brown and dun and green, sisters white and blue and grey. Some were hanged, some disemboweled. Septs have been despoiled, maidens and mothers raped by godless men and demon worshippers. Even silent sisters have been molested. The mother above cries out in her anguish. We have brought their bones here from all over the realm to bear witness to the agony of the holy faith." Circe could feel the weight of eyes upon her. "The king shall know of these atrocities," she answered solemnly. "Tommen will share your outrage. This is the work of Stannis and his Red Witch and the savage Northmen who worship trees and wolves." She raised her voice. "Good people, your dead shall be avenged." A few cheered, but only a few. "We ask no vengeance for our dead," said the one-legged man. "Only protection for the living, for the septs and holy places." "The Iron Throne must defend the faith," growled the hulking lout with a 7-pointed star painted on his brow. "A king who does not protect his people is no king at all." Mutters of assent went up from those around him. One man had the temerity to grasp Sir Merrin by the wrist and say, "It is time for all anointed knights to forsake their worldly masters and defend our holy faith. Stand with us, sir, if you love the seven." "Unhand me," said Sir Merrin, wrenching free. "I hear you," Circe said. "My son is young, but he loves the seven well. You shall have his protection and mine own." The man with the star upon his brow was not appeased. "The warrior will defend us," he said, "not this fat boy king." Merrin Trant reached for his sword, but Circe stopped him before he could unsheathe it. She had only 2 knights amidst a sea of sparrows. She saw staves and scythes, cudgels and clubs, several axes. "I will have no blood shed in this holy place, sir." "Why are all men such children? Cut him down and the rest will tear us limb from limb. We are all the mother's children. Come, His High Holiness awaits us." But as she made her way through the press to the steps of the sept, a gaggle of armed men stepped out to block the doors. They wore mail and boiled leather, with here and there a bit of dinted plate. Some had spears and some had long swords. More favored axes and had sewn red stars upon their bleached white surcoats. Two had the insolence to cross their spears and bar her way. "Is this how you receive your queen?" she demanded of them. "Pray, where are Reynard and Torbert?" It was not like those two to miss a chance to fawn on her. Torbert always made a show of getting down on his knees to wash her feet. "I do not know the men you speak of," said one of the men with a red star on his surcoat. "But if they are of the faith, no doubt the seven had need of their service." "Septon Reynard and Septon Torbert are of the most devout," Circe said, "and will be furious to learn that you obstructed me. Do you mean to deny me entrance to Baelor's holy sept?" "Your grace," said a greybeard with a stooped shoulder, "you are welcome here. But your men must leave their sword belts. No weapons are allowed within by command of the High Septon." "Knights of the King's Guard do not set aside their swords, not even in the presence of the king." "In the king's house, the king's word must rule," replied the aged knight. "But this is the house of the gods." Color rose to her cheeks. One word to Merin Trant and the stoop-backed greybeard would be meeting his gods sooner than he might have liked. "Not here, though. Not now." "Wait for me," she told the king's guard curtly. Alone, she climbed the steps. The spearmen uncrossed their spears. Two other men put their weight against the doors, and with a great groan they swung apart. In the Hall of Lamps, Circe found a score of septons on their knees, but not in prayer. They had pails of soap and water and were scrubbing at the floor. Their rough-spun robes and sandals led Circe to take them for sparrows, until one raised his head. His face was red as a beet, and there were broken blisters on his hands, bleeding. "Your grace." "Septon Reynard?" The queen could scarce believe what she was seeing. "What are you doing on your knees?"
"He is cleaning the floor."
The speaker was shorter than the queen by several inches, and as thin as a broom handle. "Work is a form of prayer, most pleasing to the smith." He stood, scrub brush in hand. "Your grace, we have been expecting you." The man's beard was grey and brown and closely trimmed, his hair tied up in a hard knot behind his head. Though his robes were clean, they were frayed and patched as well. He had rolled his sleeves up his elbows as he scrubbed, but below the knees the cloth was soaked and sodden. His face was sharply pointed with deep-set eyes as brown as mud. "His feet are bare," she saw with dismay. They were hideous as well, hard and horny things, thick with callus. "You are His High Holiness?"
"We are.
Father, give me strength." The queen knew that she should kneel, but the floor was wet with soap and dirty water, and she did not wish to ruin her gown. She glanced over the old men on their knees. "I do not see my friend Septon Torbert." "Septon Torbert has been confined to a penitent cell on bread and water. It is sinful for any man to be so plump when half the realm is starving." Circe had suffered quite enough for one day. She let him see her anger. "Is this how you greet me? With a scrub brush in your hand, dripping water, do you know who I am?" "Your grace is the queen regent of the seven kingdoms," the man said. "But in the seven pointed star, it is written that as men bow to their lords, and lords to their kings, so kings and queens must bow before the seven who are one." "Is he telling me to kneel?" If so, he did not know her very well. "By rights, you should have met me on the steps in your finest robes with the crystal crown upon your head."
"We have no crown, your grace."
Her frown deepened. "My lord father gave your predecessor a crown of rare beauty, wrought in crystal and spun gold."
"And for that gift we honor him in our prayers," the High Septon said. "But the poor need food in their bellies more than we need gold and crystal on our head. The crown has been sold. So have the others in our vaults, and all our rings, and our robes of cloth of gold and cloth of silver. Wool will keep a man as warm. That is why the seven gave us sheep."
"He is utterly mad." The most devout must have been mad as well to elevate this creature,
mad or terrified of the beggars at their doors. Kyburn's whisperers claimed that Septon Lucian had been 9 votes from elevation when those doors had given way, and the sparrows came pouring into the great sept with their leader on their shoulders and their axes in their hands. She fixed the small man with an icy stare. "Is there some place where we may speak more privily, Your Holiness?" The High Septon surrendered his scrub brush to one of the most devout. "If Your Grace will follow us?" He led her through the inner doors into the sept proper. Their footsteps echoed off the marble floor. Dust motes swam in the beams of colored light slanting down through the leaded glass of the great dome. Incense sweetened the air, and beside the 7 altars candles shone like stars. 1,000 twinkled for the mother, and near as many for the maid. But you could count the stranger's candles on 2 hands and still have fingers left. Even here the sparrows had invaded. 12 scruffy hedge knights were kneeling before the warrior, beseeching him to bless the swords they had piled at his feet. At the mother's altar, a septon was leading 100 sparrows in prayer, their voices as distant as waves upon the shore. The high septon led Circe to where the crone raised her lantern. When he knelt before the altar, she had no choice but to kneel beside him. Mercifully, this high septon was not as long-winded as the fat one had been. I should be grateful for that much, I suppose. His High Holiness made no move to rise when his prayer was done. It would seem they must confer upon their knees. A small man's ploy, she thought, amused. High Holiness, she said, these sparrows are frightening the city. I want them gone. Where should they go, Your Grace? There are 7 hells, any one of them will serve. Back where they came from, I would imagine. They came from everywhere. As the sparrow is the humblest and most common of the birds, they are the humblest and most common of men. They are common, we agree on that much. Have you seen what they have done to Blessed Baylor's statue? They befoul the plaza with their pigs and goats and night soil. Night soil can be washed away more easily than blood, Your Grace. If the plaza was befouled, it was befouled by the execution that was done here. He dares throw Ned Stark in my face. We all regret that. Joffrey was young and not as wise as he might have been. Lord Stark should have been beheaded elsewhere out of respect for Blessed Baylor. But the man was a traitor. Let us not forget. King Baylor forgave those who conspired against him. King Baylor imprisoned his own sisters whose only crime was being beautiful. The first time Circe heard that tale, she had gone to Tyrion's nursery and pinched the little monster till he cried. I should have pinched his nose shut and stuffed my sock into his mouth. She forced herself to smile. King Tommen will forgive the sparrows, too, once they have returned to their homes. Most have lost their homes. Suffering is everywhere, and grief, and death. Before coming to King's Landing, I tended to 50 little villages, too small to have a septon of their own. I walked from each one to the next, performing marriages, absolving sinners of their sins, naming newborn children. Those villages are no more, Your Grace. Weeds and thorns grow where gardens once flourished, and bones litter the roadsides. War is a dreadful thing. These atrocities are the work of the Northmen, and of Lord Stannis and his demon worshippers. Some of my sparrows speak of bands of lions who despoiled them, and of the hound who was your own sworn man. At Salt Pans he slew an aged septon and despoiled a girl of 12, an innocent child promised to the faith. He wore his armor as he raped her, and her tender flesh was torn and crushed by his iron mail. When he was done, he gave her to his men, who cut off her nose and nipples. His Grace cannot be held responsible for the crimes of every man who ever served House Lannister. Sandor Clegane is a traitor and a brute. Why do you think I dismissed him from our service? He fights for the outlaw Beric Dondarrion now, not for King Tommen. As you say, yet it must be asked, where were the king's knights when these things were being done? Did not Jaehaerys the conciliator once swear upon the Iron Throne itself that the crown would always protect and defend the faith? Circe had no idea what Jaehaerys the Conciliator might have sworn. He did She agreed, and the High Septon blessed him and anointed him as king. It is traditional for every new High Septon to give the king his blessing, and yet you have refused to bless King Tommen. Your Grace is mistaken. We have not refused. You have not come. The hour is not yet ripe. Are you a priest or a greengrocer? And what might I do to make it riper? If he dares mention gold, I will deal with this one as I did the last, and find a pious 8-year-old to wear the crystal crown. The realm is full of kings. For the faith to exalt one above the rest, we must be certain. 300 years ago, when Aegon the Dragon landed beneath this very hill, the High Septon locked himself within the starry sept of Old Town and prayed for 7 days and 7 nights, taking no nourishment but bread and water. When he emerged, he announced that the faith would not oppose Aegon and his sisters, for the crone had lifted up her lamp to show him what lay ahead. If Old Town took up arms against the dragon, Old Town would burn, and the High Tower and the Citadel and the Starry Sept would be cast down and destroyed. Lord Hightower was a godly man. When he heard the prophecy, he kept his strength at home and opened the city gates to Aegon when he came, and his High Holiness anointed the conqueror with the 7 oils. I must do as he did 300 years ago. I must pray and fast. For 7 days and 7 nights? For as long as need be. Circe itched to slap his solemn, pious face. I could help you fast, she thought. I could shut you up in some tower and see that no one brings you food until the gods have spoken. These false kings espouse false gods, she reminded him. Only King Tommen defends the holy faith. Yet everywhere septs are burned and looted. Even silent sisters have been raped, crying their anguish to the sky. Your Grace has seen the bones and skulls of our holy dead. I have, she had to say. Give Tommen your blessing, and he shall put an end to these outrages. And how shall he do that, Your Grace? Will he send a knight to walk the roads with every begging brother? Will he give us men to guard our scepters against the wolves and lions? I will pretend you did not mention lions. The realm is at war. His Grace has need of every man. Circe did not intend to squander Tommen's strength playing wet nurse to sparrows or guarding the wrinkled cunts of 1,000 sour scepters. Half of them are probably praying for a good raping. Your sparrows have clubs and axes. Let them defend themselves. King Maegor's laws prohibit that, as your Grace must know. It was by his decree that the faith laid down its swords. Tommen is king now, not Maegor. What did she care what Maegor the Cruel had decreed 300 years ago? Instead of taking the swords out of the hands of the faithful, he should have used them for his own ends. She pointed to where the warrior stood above his altar of red marble. What is that he holds? A sword. Has he forgotten how to use it? Maegor's laws could be undone. She let that hang there, waiting for the High Sparrow to rise to the bait. He did not disappoint her. The faith militant, reborn? That would be the answer to 300 years of prayer, Your Grace. The warrior would lift his shining sword again and cleanse this sinful realm of all its evil. If His Grace were to allow me to restore the ancient blessed orders of the sword and star, every godly man in the 7 kingdoms would know him to be our true and rightful lord. That was sweet to hear, but Circe took care not to seem too eager. Your High Holiness spoke of forgiveness earlier. In these troubled times, King Tommen would be most grateful if you could see your way to forgiving Crown's debt. It seems to me we owe the faith some 900,000 dragons. 900,674 dragons. Gold that could feed the hungry and rebuild 1,000 septs. Is it gold you want? The queen asked. Or do you want these dusty laws of Maegor's set aside? The High Septon pondered that a moment. As you wish. This debt shall be forgiven, and King Tommen will have his blessing. The warrior's sons shall escort me to him, shining in the glory of their faith, whilst my sparrows go forth to defend the meek and humble of the land, reborn as poor fellows as of old." The queen got to her feet and smoothed her skirts. "I shall have the papers drawn up, and His Grace will sign them and affix them with the royal seal." If there was one part of kingship that Tommen loved, it was playing with his seal. "Seven save His Grace. Long may he reign." The High Septon made a steeple of his hands and raised his eyes to heaven. "Let the wicked tremble." "Do you hear that, Lord Stannis?" Circe could not help but smile. Even her lord father could have done no better. At a stroke, she had rid King's Landing of the plague of sparrows, secured Tommen's blessing, and lessened the crown's debt by close to 1,000,000 dragons. Her heart was soaring as she allowed the High Septon to escort her back to the Hall of Lamps. Lady Merryweather shared the queen's delight, though she had never heard of the warrior's sons or the poor fellows. "They date from before Aegon's conquest," Circe explained to her. "The warrior's sons were an order of knights who gave up their lands and gold and swore their swords to His High Holiness. The poor fellows, they were humbler, though far more numerous, begging brothers of a sort, though they carried axes instead of bowls. They wandered the roads, escorting travellers from sept to sept and town to town. Their badge was the seven-pointed star, red on white, so the small folk named them stars. The warrior's sons wore rainbow cloaks and inlaid silver armor over hair shirts, and bore star-shaped crystals in the pummels of their longswords. They were the swords. Holy men, ascetics, fanatics, sorcerers, dragon slayers, demon hunters. There were many tales about them. But all agree that they were implacable in their hatred for all enemies of the holy faith." Lady Merryweather understood at once. "Enemies such as Lord Stannis and his red sorceress, perhaps." "Why, yes, as it happens," said Circe, giggling like a girl. "Shall we broach a flagon of Hippocras and drink to the fervor of the warrior's sons on our way home?" "To the fervor of the warrior's sons and the brilliance of the queen regent, to Circe, the first of her name." The Hippocras was as sweet and savory as Circe's triumph, and the queen's litter seemed almost afloat back across the city. But at the base of Aegon's high hill, they encountered Margaery Tyrell and her cousins returning from a ride. "She dogs me everywhere I go," Circe thought with annoyance, when she laid eyes on the little queen. Behind Margaery came a long tail of courtiers, guards, and servants, many of them laden with baskets of fresh flowers. Each of her cousins had an admirer in thrall. The gangly squire, Alan Ambrose, rode with Eleanor, to whom he was betrothed. Sir Tallard, with Shy Alla, one-armed Mark Mullendore, with Mega, plump and laughing. The Redwine twins were escorting two of Margaery's other ladies, Meredith Crane and Jenna Fossaway. The women all wore flowers in their hair. Jalabar Zoe had attached himself to the party too, as had Sir Lambert Turnberry, with his eye patch, and the handsome singer known as the Blue Bard. And of course a knight of the Kingsguard must accompany the little queen, and of course it is the Knight of Flowers. In white scale armor chased with gold, Sir Loras glittered. Though he no longer presumed to train Tommen at arms, the king still spent far too much time in his company. Every time the boy returned from an afternoon with his little wife, he had some new tale to tell about something that Sir Loras had said or done. Margaery hailed them when the two columns met, and fell in beside the queen's litter. Her cheeks were flushed, her brown ringlets tumbling loosely about her shoulders, stirred by every puff of wind. "We have been picking autumn flowers in the Kingswood," she told them. "I know where you were," the queen thought. Her informers were very good about keeping her apprised of Margaery's movements. Such a restless girl, our little queen. She seldom let more than 3 days pass without going off for a ride. Some days they would ride along the Rosby Road to hunt for shells and eat beside the sea. Other times she would take her entourage across the river for an afternoon of hawking. The little queen was fond of going out on boats as well, sailing up and down the Blackwater Rush to no particular purpose. When she was feeling pious, she would leave the castle to pray at Baylor's Sept. She gave her custom to a dozen different seamstresses, was well known amongst the city's goldsmiths, and had even been known to visit the fish market by the Mudgate for a look at the day's catch. Wherever she went, the small folk fawned on her, and Lady Marjorie did all she could to fan their ardour. She was forever giving alms to beggars, buying hot pies off bakers' carts, and reining up to speak to common tradesmen. Had it been up to her, she would have had Tommen doing all these things as well. She was forever inviting him to accompany her and her hens on their adventures, and the boy was forever pleading with his mother for leave to go along. The Queen had given her consent a few times, if only to allow Sir Osney to spend a few more hours in Marjorie's company. For all the good it has done, Osney has proved a grievous disappointment. "Do you remember the day your sister sailed for Dorne?" Circe asked her son. "Do you recall the mob howling on our way back to the castle? The stones? The curses?" But the king was deaf to sense, thanks to his little queen. "If we mingle with the commons, they will love us better." The mob loved the fat High Septon so well they tore him limb from limb, and him a holy man, she reminded him. All it did was make him sullen with her. "Just as Marjorie wants, I wager. Every day in every way she tries to steal him from me." Joffrey would have seen through her schemer's smile and let her know her place, but Tommen was more gullible. She knew Joff was too strong for her, Circe thought, remembering the gold coin Qyburn had found. For House Tyrell to hope to rule, he had to be removed. It came back to her that Marjorie and her hideous grandmother had once plotted to marry Sansa Stark to the little queen's crippled brother Willis. Lord Tywin had forestalled that by stealing a march on them and wedding Sansa to Tyrion, but the link had been there. "They are all in it together," she realized with a start. "The Tyrells bribed the jailers to free Tyrion and whisked him down the Rose Road to join his vile bride. By now the both of them are safe in Highgarden, hidden away behind a wall of roses." "You should have come along with us, Your Grace," the little schemer prattled on as they climbed the slope of Aegon's High Hill. "We could have had such a lovely time together. The trees are gowned in gold and red and orange, and there are flowers everywhere. Chestnuts, too. We roasted some on our way home." "I have no time for riding through the woods and picking flowers," Circe said. "I have a kingdom to rule." "Only one, Your Grace? Who rules the other six?" Marjorie laughed a merry little laugh. "You will forgive me my jest, I hope. I know what a burden you bear. You should let me share the load. There must be some things I could do to help you. It would put to rest all this talk that you and I are rivals for the king." "Is that what they say?" Circe smiled. "How foolish. I have never looked upon you as a rival, not even for a moment." "I am so pleased to hear that." The girl did not seem to realize that she had been cut. "You and Tommen must come with us the next time. I know His Grace would love it. The Blue Bard played for us, and Sir Talad showed us how to fight with a staff the way the small folk do. The woods are so beautiful in autumn." "My late husband loved the forest, too." In the early years of their marriage, Robert was forever imploring her to hunt with him, but Circe had always begged off. His hunting trips allowed her time with Jaime. Golden days and silver nights. It was a dangerous dance that they had danced, to be sure. Eyes and ears were everywhere within the Red Keep, and one could never be certain when Robert would return. Somehow the peril had only served to make their time together that much more thrilling. "Still, beauty can sometimes mask deadly danger," she warned the little queen. "Robert lost his life in the woods." Marjorie smiled at Sir Loras, a sweet, sisterly smile full of fondness. "Your Grace is kind to fear for me, but my brother keeps me well protected." "Go and hunt," Circe had urged Robert 100 times. "My brother keeps me well protected." She recalled what Tena had told her earlier, and a laugh came bursting from her lips. "Your Grace laughs so prettily." Lady Marjorie gave her a quizzical smile. "Might we share the jest?" "You will," The queen said, I promise you, you will.
John. When he heard the order, Sir Alistair's mouth twisted into a semblance of a smile, but his eyes remained as cold and hard as flint. So, the bastard boy sends me out to die.
Die,
cried Mormont's raven.
Die, die, die.
You are not helping. John swatted the bird away. The bastard boy is sending you out to range, to find our foes, and kill them if need be. You are skilled with a blade. You are master at arms here and at Eastwatch. Thorn touched the hilt of his longsword. I have squandered a third of my life trying to teach the rudiments of swordplay to churls, muttonheads, and knaves. Small good that will do me in those woods. Diamond will be with you, and another seasoned ranger.
We'll learn you what you need to know, sir.
Diamond told Thorn, cackling.
Teach you how to wipe your high-born arse with leaves, just like a proper ranger.
Kedge Whiteye laughed at that, and Blackjack Bulwer spat. Sir Alistair only said,
You would like me to refuse. Then you could hack off me head, same as you did for Slint. I not give you that pleasure, bastard. You'd best pray that it's a wildling blade that kills me, though. The ones the others kill don't stay dead, and they remember. I'm coming back, Lord Snow.
I pray you do. John would never count Sir Alistair Thorne amongst his friends, but he was still a brother. No one ever said you had to like your brothers. It was no easy thing to send men into the wild, knowing that the chances were good that they might never return. They are all seasoned men, John told himself. But his uncle Benjen and his rangers had been seasoned men as well, and the haunted forest had swallowed them up without a trace. When two of them finally came straggling back to the wall, it had been as whites. Not for the first time or the last, Jon Snow found himself wondering what had become of Benjen Stark. Perhaps the rangers would come upon some sign of them, he told himself, never truly believing it. Dywin would lead one ranging, Blackjack Bulwer and Kedge Whiteye the other two. They at least were eager for the duty.
Feels good to have a horse under me again, Dywin said at the gate, sucking on his wooden teeth. Begging your pardon, my lord, but we was all of us getting splinters up our arses from sitting about.
No man in Castle Black knew the woods as well as Dywin did, the trees and streams, the plants that could be eaten, the ways of predator and prey. Thorn is in better hands than he deserves. John watched the riders go from atop the wall. Three parties, each of three men, each carrying a pair of ravens. From on high their garrons looked no larger than ants, and John could not tell one ranger from another. He knew them, though. Every name was graven on his heart. Eight good men, he thought. And one, well, we shall see. When the last of the riders had disappeared into the trees, Jon Snow rode the winch cage down with Dolorous Ed. A few scattered snowflakes were falling as they made their slow descent, dancing on the gusty wind. One followed the cage down, drifting just beyond the bars. It was falling faster than they were descending, and from time to time it would vanish beneath them. Then a gust of wind would catch it and push it upwards once again. John could have reached through the bars and caught it, if he had wished.
"I had a frightening dream last night, my lord," Dolorous Ed confessed. "You were my steward, eh? Fetching my food and cleaning up my leavings. I was Lord Commander, with never a moment's peace."
John did not smile. "Your nightmare, my life." Cutterpike's galleys were reporting ever-increasing numbers of free folk along the wooded shores to the north and east of the wall. Camps had been seen, half-built rafts, even the hull of a broken cog that someone had begun repairing. The wildlings always vanished into the woods when seen, no doubt to re-emerge as soon as Pike's ships had passed. Meanwhile, Sir Denis Mallister was still seeing fires in the night north of the gorge. Both commanders were asking for more men.
And where am I to get more men?
John had sent 10 of the Molestown wildlings to each of them. Green boys, old men, some wounded and infirm, but all capable of doing work of one sort or another. Far from being pleased, Pike and Mallister had both written back to complain.
When I asked for men, I had in mind men of the Night's Watch, trained and disciplined, whose loyalty I should never have reason to doubt, wrote Sir Denis.
Cutter Pike was blunter. I could hang them from the wall as a warning to other wildlings to stay away, but I don't see any other use for them. Maester Harmoon wrote for him.
I wouldn't trust such to clean my chamber pot, and 10 is not enough.
The iron cage moved downward at the end of its long chain, creaking and rattling, until it finally jerked to a halt a foot above the ground at the base of the wall. Dolorous Ed pushed open the door and hopped down, his boots breaking the crust of the last snow. John followed. Outside the armory, Iron Emmett was still urging on his charges in the yard. The song of steel on steel woke a hunger in John. It reminded him of warmer, simpler days when he had been a boy at Winterfell, matching blades with Rob, under the watchful eye of Sir Roderick Cassel. Sir Roderick, too, had fallen, slain by Theon Turncloak and his iron men as he tried to retake Winterfell. The great stronghold of House Stark was a scorched desolation. All my memories are poisoned. When Iron Emmett spied him, he raised a hand, and combat ceased.
Lord Commander, how may we serve you?
With your three best. Emmett grinned.
Aaron, Emric, Jace.
Horse and Hop Robin fetched padding for the Lord Commander, along with a ringmail hauberk to go over it, and greaves, gorget, and half-helm. A black shield rimmed with iron for his left arm, a blunted longsword for his right hand. The sword gleamed silvery grey in the dawn light, almost new. One of the last to come from Donald's forge. A pity he didn't live long enough to put an edge on it. The blade was shorter than Longclaw, but made of common steel, which made it heavier. His blows would be a little slower. It will serve. John turned to face his foes.
Come!
Which one do you want first? Asked Aaron.
All three of you, at once.
Three on one? Jace was incredulous. That wouldn't be fair.
He was one of Conway's latest bunch, a cobbler's son from Fair Isle. Maybe that explained it.
True? Come here.
When he did, John's blade slammed him alongside his head, knocking him off his feet. In the blink of an eye, the boy had a boot on his chest and a sword point at his throat. War is never fair, John told him. It's 2-on-1 now, and you're dead. When he heard gravel crunch, he knew the twins were coming. Those two will make rangers yet. He spun, blocking Aaron's cut with the edge of his shield and meeting Emric's with his sword.
Those aren't spears, he shouted. Get in close.
He went to the attack to show them how it was done. Emric first. He slashed at his head and shoulders, right and left and right again. The boy got his shield up and tried a clumsy counter cut. John slammed his own shield into Emric's and brought him down with a blow to the lower leg, none too soon, because Aaron was on him, with a crunching cut to the back of his thigh which sent him to one knee. That will leave a bruise. He caught the next cut on his shield, then lurched back to his feet and drove Aaron across the yard. He's quick, he thought, as the long swords kissed once and twice and thrice. But he needs to get stronger. When he saw relief in Aaron's eyes, he knew Emric was behind him. He came around and dealt him a cut to the back of the shoulders that sent him crashing into his brother. By that time, Jace had found his feet, so John put him down again. I hate it when dead men get up.
You'll feel the same the day you meet a white." Stepping back, he lowered his sword.
"The big crow can peck the little crows," growled a voice behind him. "But has he belly enough to fight a man?"
Rattleshirt was leaning against a wall. A coarse stubble covered his sunken cheeks, and thin brown hair was blowing across his little yellow eyes. "You flatter yourself," John said.
"Aye, but I flatten you."
Stannis burned the wrong man.
"No."
The wildling grinned at him through a mouth of brown and broken teeth.
"He burned the man he had to burn, for all the world to see. We all do what we have to do, Snow, even kings."
"Emmett, find some armour for him. I want him in steel, not old bones." Once clad in mail and plate, the Lord of Bones seemed to stand a little straighter. He seemed taller, too, his shoulders thicker and more powerful than John would have thought. "It's the armour, not the man," he told himself. Even Sam could appear almost formidable, clad head to heel in Donald Noy's steel. The wildling waved away the shield Horse offered him. Instead, he asked for a two-handed sword.
"There's a sweet sound," he said, slashing at the air. "Flap closer, Snow, or I mean to make your feathers fly."
John rushed him hard. Rattleshirt took a step backwards and met the charge with a two-handed slash. If John had not interposed his shield, it might have staved his breastplate in and broken half his ribs. The force of the blow staggered him for a moment and sent a solid jolt up his arm. "He hits harder than I would have thought." His quickness was another unpleasant surprise. They circled round each other, trading blow for blow. The Lord of Bones gave as good as he was getting. By right, the two-handed greatsword should have been a deal more cumbersome than John's longsword, but the wildling wielded it with blinding speed. Arn Emmett's fledglings cheered their Lord Commander at the start, but the relentless speed of Rattleshirt's attack soon beat them down to silence.
"He cannot keep this up for long," John told himself as he stopped another blow.
The impact made him grunt. Even dulled, the greatsword cracked his pinewood shield and bent the iron rim.
"He will tire soon. He must."
John slashed at the wildling's face, and Rattleshirt pulled back his head. He hacked down at Rattleshirt's calf, only to have him deftly leap the blade. The greatsword crashed down onto John's shoulder, hard enough to ding his pauldron and numb the arm beneath. John backed away. The Lord of Bones came after, chortling. "He has no shield," John reminded himself, "and that monster sword's too cumbersome for parries. I should be landing two blows for every one of his." Somehow he wasn't, though, and the blows he did land were having no effect. The wildling always seemed to be moving away or sliding sideways, so John's longsword glanced off a shoulder or an arm. Before long, he found himself giving more ground, trying to avoid the other's crashing cuts and failing half the time. His shield had been reduced to kindling. He shook it off his arm. Sweat was running down his face and stinging his eyes beneath his helm. "He is too strong and too quick," he realized, "and with that great sword he has weight and reach on me." It would have been a different fight if John had been armed with Longclaw, but his chance came on Rattleshirt's next backswing. John threw himself forward, bullying into the other man, and they went down together, legs entangled. Steel slammed on steel. Both men lost their swords as they rolled on the hard ground. The wildling drove a knee between John's legs. John lashed out with a mail fist. Somehow Rattleshirt ended up on top. With John's head in his hands, he smashed it against the ground, then wrenched his visor open.
"If I had me a dagger, you'd be less than I by now," he snarled, before Horse and Iron Emmett dragged him off the Lord Commander's chest. "Let go me, you bloody crows," he roared.
John struggled to one knee. His head was ringing and his mouth was full of blood. He spat it out and said, "Well fought."
"You flatter yourself, crow. I never broke a sweat."
"Next time you will," said John. Dolorous Ed helped him to his feet and unbuckled his helm. It had acquired several deep dents that had not been there when he donned it. "Release him." John tossed the helm to Hop Robin, who dropped it. "My lord," said Iron Emmet, "he threatened your life, we all heard. He said that if he had a dagger..." "He does have a dagger, right there on his belt." "There is always someone quicker and stronger," Sir Roderick had once told John and Rob. "He's the man you want to face in the yard, before you need to face his like upon a battlefield." "Lord Snow," a soft voice said. He turned to find Clytus standing beneath the broken archway, a parchment in his hand. "From Stannis?" John had been hoping for some word from the king. The Night's Watch took no part in you, and it should not matter to him which king emerged triumphant. Somehow it did. "Is it Deepwood?"
No, my lord."
Clytus thrust the parchment forward. It was tightly rolled and sealed with a button of hard pink wax. "Only the Dreadfort uses pink sealing wax." John ripped off his gauntlet, took the letter, cracked the seal. When he saw the signature, he forgot the battering Rattleshirt had given him. "Ramsay Bolton, Lord of the Hornwood," it read, in a huge spiky hand. The brown ink came away in flakes when John brushed it with his thumb. Beneath Bolton's signature, Lord Dustin, Lady Serwin, and four Risewells had appended their own marks and seals. A cruder hand had drawn the giant of House Umber. "Might we know what it says, my lord?" asked Iron Emmet. John saw no reason not to tell him. "Moat Cailin is taken. The flayed corpses of the Iron Men have been nailed to posts along the King's Road. Roose Bolton summons all leal lords to Barrowton to affirm their loyalty to the Iron Throne and celebrate his son's wedding to—" His heart seemed to stop for a moment. "No, that is not possible. She died in King's Landing with father." "Lord Snow?" Clytus peered at him closely with his dim pink eyes. "Are you unwell? You seem—" "He's to marry Arya Stark, my little sister." John could almost see her in that moment, long-faced and gawky, all knobby knees and sharp elbows with her dirty face and tangled hair. They would wash the one and comb the other, he did not doubt, but he could not imagine Arya in a wedding gown, nor Ramsay Bolton's bed. "No matter how afraid she is, she will not show it. If he tries to lay a hand on her, she'll fight him." "Your sister," Iron Emmet said, "how old is she?" "By now she'd be 11, John thought. "Still a child." "I have no sister. Only brothers. Only you." Lady Caitlin would have rejoiced to hear those words, he knew. That did not make them easier to say. His fingers closed around the parchment. Would that they could crush Ramsay Bolton's throat as easily. Clytus cleared his throat.
"Will there be an answer?"
John shook his head and walked away. By nightfall, the bruises that Rattleshirt had given him had turned purple. "They'll go yellow before they fade away," he told Mormont's raven. "I'll look as sallow as the Lord of Bones."
"Bones!"
the bird agreed.
"Bones! Bones!"
He could hear the faint murmur of voices coming from outside, although the sound was too weak to make out words. They sound 1,000 leagues away. It was Lady Melisandre and her followers at their night fire. Every night at dusk the Red Woman led her followers in their twilight prayer, asking her Red God to see them through the dark. For the night is dark and full of terrors. With Stannis and most of the Queen's men gone, her flock was much diminished. 50 of the free folk up from Molestown, the handful of guards the King had left her, perhaps 12 black brothers who had taken her Red God for their own. John felt as stiff as a man of 60 years. Dark dreams, he thought, and guilt. His thoughts kept returning to Arya. "There is no way.
I can help her. I put all kin aside when I said my words. If one of my men told me his sister was in peril, I would tell him that was no concern of his. Once a man had said the words,